Right. So a very good evening. So today, Tuesday today, the 15th of February, is also the 14th of the first Adar, and therefore it is what's called Purim Katan, the little Purim, minor Purim, and it's exactly a month before the real Purim, the major Purim, which is the 14th of the second Adar. The sages tell us, that Adar, the Purim should be a month before Pesach, so that it helps one, you know, like remember how everything fits together. So when there's two Adar, as there are this year, so the 14th of the first Adar is called Purim Katan, the minor Purim. So the discourse that we have is one that was said in 1967 on Shushan Purim Katan, that means like tomorrow, which is Shushan Purim. And it's about the basic concept of the Purim story. So what I'm gonna look at first of all is the verse from the Megillat Esther, from the scroll of Esther. And that introduces the whole theme of the discourse. So this is towards the end of the Book of Esther. It's after the whole wonderful transformation of darkness to light and the negativity, the terrible persecution that Haman wanted to carry out, or destruction that he wanted to carry out against the Jews, God forbid, and he was foiled. And it then says, "V'kibel ha'yehudim et asher hecheilu la'asot." The Jews accepted on themselves what they had begun to do. "V'et asher katav Mordechai aleihem," and what Mordechai had written to them. Now, in its simple sense, here in the Megillah, it's the trut, you could say, is that the Jews are accepting the idea of celebrating Purim as a festival year by year, because they it was changed from sorrow to joy, and so every year, you see, here we have the idea that Mordechai sent dispatches to all the Jews, charging them to observe the 14th and 15th days of Adar every year, celebrating Purim. So that's the normal, that's the simple way of understanding it in the text. However, the sages in the Talmud give another dimension to this. And what they say in the Talmud, which is in Shabbat, page 88a, it says there, it's describing the giving of the Torah. And it says that when the Torah was given, there's a famous interpretation, which the Talmud quotes, that it says the Jewish people, the Israelites, gathered under the mountain. So what does it mean, under the mountain? So there's a comment by the sages that God held the mountain over them and said, if you accept the Torah, it's good. And if not, then, you know, it won't be good. So the Talmud then says, wait a minute, this means the Torah was forced on us. We were forced to keep the Torah. And so if we're forced to keep the Torah, does it have any legal validity? You see, the seven Noahide laws every human being has to keep. But the extra commandments of Judaism, like Shabbat and Kashrut and things like that, God gave us those commandments. And the idea is that we accepted them. So if we're forced into them, then that's an excuse against keeping them. And so the Talmud said, well, no problem. We re-accepted the Torah on Purim. And that's what it means when it says this verse. Let's go back to the verse in the book of Esther. The Kibbel HaYehudim, the Jews accepted, Eit HaShe'echelu La'asot, which they had begun keeping, which means they began keeping it at Mount Sinai. They began keeping it at Mount Sinai. And only then, at Purim, did they accept it. I think maybe let's look at this in the Talmud as well. So we'll just see that in Shabbat. One second. Here. You see, I'm going to read it here in Hebrew. Vayityatzvu betachtit ha'or. They stood under the mountain. Amar Rav Avdimi Barcham Barchasa, this rabbi said, Melamed, that teaches us shekafa hakadosh baruch hu alein. Wait a minute. Can you see what I'm reading?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you can see it? Okay.
Yes.
Right. Okay. This teaches us that God held over them the mountain, kegigit, like a kind of a barrel. God held the mountain over them like a barrel. Va'amalehem, and he said to them, Imatem mekablim ha'Torah mutav, if you accept the Torah, it will be good. Ve'imlav, and if not, sham tehei kfuratchem, there will be your graves. Terrible statement. Amar Rav Acha bar Yaakov, then Rav Acha, the son of Jacob, says, Mikan moda rabba loraita. This is an excuse against keeping the Torah. Omar Rava, so Rava says, no, it's not. Afal pichein, because even so, hadur kablu bimea chashverosh. They re-accepted the Torah in the time of Achashverosh, that means the Purim story, dichtiv, Kimu v'kiblu ha'yehudim, the Jews accepted and they upheld and accepted. It's actually a slightly different verse, but it's the same theme in the book of Esther. Kimu ma shekiblu kfar, they accepted they upheld what they'd already accepted. So that's. So that's this passage from the Talmud. Okay, so with that, we're going to start exploring the discourse, which was said in 1967. It was Shabbat. That week was Parshat Ki Tisa, as it is now. And it was then Shushan Purim Katan. And today it's Purim Katan. Tonight, actually, it's Shushan Purim Katan. So that fits with what we're doing. And so we will hear the melody of the discourse, if I can find it.
It can be referred to as a Yom Tov, Rebbe Tali.
It is a Yom Tov, and it's a little Yom Tov. One doesn't say Tachnut. Right. So generally when we, at Shachrit and Mincha, after the Shmona Esher, one says Tachnun, and on Purim Katan and on Shushan Purim Katan, one doesn't say Tachnun.
Don't say, you don't bow. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right, thank you. Were you able to hear the sound properly?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Good. Right, okay.
Yes.
Lovely, thank you. So here we have the discourse said in 1967 on Shushan Purim Katan. The Jewish people accepted or what they'd begun doing. And the previous Rebbe explains now, as you know, the discourses of the Rebbe generally are referencing a previous discourse by one of the earlier six leaders of Chabad. The Rebbe is the seventh, and there are six leaders before, and they all gave most wonderful Hasidic teachings. And here he's commenting on a teaching of his predecessor, his immediate predecessor, the previous Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, Joseph Isaac, who was also our Rebbe's father-in-law. And this Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak explains in his discourse, which he said on Purim Katan, on the same day of Minor Purim, 40 years before 1967. Now, 40 years before 1967 was 1927. And then that was the last year that he was in Russia. That was a very, very dangerous time. And some not very long after that, the Rebbe, a few months after that, the Rebbe was in fact arrested in Russia. And there is a whole thing about how he was arrested, and eventually in a remarkable way he was freed, but he had to leave Russia. His life was saved, thank God, by a miracle. And then he left Russia. So this was, and what happened, what was happening on Purim Katan was that the Rebbe at this point was in Moscow, and it was a very, very difficult time for the Jewish people. Shockingly difficult. The immediate opening years of the Bolshevik Revolution from 1917 onwards, it was very obscure exactly what was happening. Officially, Russia was against anti-Semitism. Communism was against anti-Semitism. That was a mark of capitalism and decadence, bourgeois decadence, and so on. But then the communist philosophy began to kick in, which unfortunately, unnecessarily in certain senses, as the Rebbe points out in the letter, unnecessarily was atheistic in its style. And they therefore banned the teaching of children religion. When a child is grown up to 18 years old, then he or she can make their own decision whether they want to read this or read that or carry out this custom or that custom, but you could not teach children. And of course, even adults, if they are keeping some kind of religious practice, that might be considered anti-revolutionary or something like that. Now, this was a blanket law in Russia. And it affected, in theory, it affected the Christians, the Muslims, and the Jews as well. But it was the Jewish communists who were very enthusiastic about implementing these laws. And the Jewish communists, called the Yevsektsiya, the Jewish section of the Communist Party, they worked very hard to stamp out Judaism, to get rabbis arrested and often killed, so as to make sure that the new universal ethos of communism, of Marxism, would rule, and there wouldn't be any old-fashioned religion getting in the way. So that was the atmosphere in Russia at that point. And Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, from the very beginning of this turn of events, you know, something like 1921, something like that, he got together a group of Hasidim and took a large map of Russia. And he said he's dividing this map up into 10 sections. And he wants a Chassid to step forward. He wants 10 Hasidim to step forward and take under their responsibility 1/10 of Russia. And they stepped forward. And the man who was actually the first to step forward was Rabbi Ben Tzion Shem Tov, Zichrono Libracha, who both Rabbi Lu and myself knew, a very, very remarkable man. And his son-in-law was Rabbi Nachman Tzudak, Alav HaShalom, who ran, he was the emissary of the Rebbe to the UK and set up all the different Lubavitch branches around the UK. It was all under his aegis. At some point he got the OBE as well, Rabbi Nachman Tzudak. So all that goes back to this time in the 1920s with the previous Rebbe trying to save Judaism in Russia in the atmosphere of communism. Now, by the time...
Can I just say something about that? I used to learn with his daughter, Rabbi, Rebbetzin Tzudak. I remember her telling us that when she was 14, her father used to say to her, you have to give shiurim, you have to start giving shiurim, and she was nervous, but she was only 14 years old in Russia, and she was teaching other women Chassidus and the parasha, and I just thought that was amazing for a 14-year-old girl to be teaching in, communist Russia. I just thought that was incredible. So, sorry, I just wanted to say that.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that. That's very beautiful. That's very lovely. That's Mrs. Fradel Tzudak, is all the same. Yes, and that's a very wonderful thing. I actually had not heard that story from her or about her, and that's very interesting to hear. That's a very remarkable lady. Mm. Now, so 1927, by this time, quite a few of Rabbi Yosef Yitzhak's emissaries had been arrested, some had been killed. And he himself was going to be arrested in a few months, like we know that that's going to happen. But what he does now, on Purim Katan, he's in Moscow, and he makes a big public event, turning on all the lights in the synagogue, and Jews crowd to the synagogue, and there are people excitedly outside. It's a very big event in Moscow at this point. In a sense, right in the face of the Svetia, the communists, everything. And that's where he taught a beautiful teaching, which is what this teaching by the Rebbe 40 years later is discussing. So he taught the Atta. Now we are on line 5. We're on page 5, and it's line 5. The Atah b'zman galut, now, in the time of exile, heim kiblu ma she'echelu kvar b'zman d'matan Torah. We have accepted on us, or they accepted on us, what they had previously begun at the time of the giving of the Torah, as the sages said in the Talmud, as we saw it, on that verse, kimu v'kiblu ha'yehudim, the Jews upheld that which they had accepted. They upheld now, or then, they upheld then in the time of Ahasuerus, the time of Purim, what they had already received at the time of the giving of the Torah. All right, so let's, so therefore, we've got the basic picture as presented by the Talmud, that we've got the giving of the Torah, and somehow the giving of the Torah is not a firm enough acceptance by the Jewish people of the Torah. Right, there's the idea it was forced on them, that there are various Hasidic ways of explaining that. They were so filled with love of God and excitement and enthusiasm, having come out of Egypt and then seeing the splitting of the Red Sea and getting the manna in the desert and defeating Amalek and all the different things that happened, that they were like swept along on a wave. And it wasn't like a cold, rational decision. Whereas when we come to, everything was going so well. Whereas when we come to the time of Purim, then everything is very difficult. Haman is threatening the whole Jewish people. And it's then that we see the power of self-sacrifice in the Jew. And that is when they really, really accepted the Torah. So now the previous Rebbe presented this concept from the Talmud, line 9, Umaksha, and he asked the question. This is very surprising. When we're talking about the giving of the Torah, the Jewish people were the highest you can imagine. Godliness was tangibly revealed. As it says, that God descended, the divine presence descended on Mount Sinai, and it had an effect not only on the Jewish people, but on the whole of existence. As the sages say, that the voice which came out saying, I am the Lord your God, it came out from all four directions of the world, north, west, south, and east, and from above and below. And the birds didn't chirp, and nothing, no bird moved. The whole world was silent and listening, which shows the tremendous bitul, the abnegation of the whole world in this stillness and silence, listening to this divine pronouncements of the Ten Commandments. Because if anything moves in any way, it expresses it's got a will and it's moving. But this is a suspension of everything. There's just God communicating. So that was an amazing thing at Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah. Whereas the time of exile, it's completely the opposite, especially when we think of the time of Haman. Shabikesh, he wanted, God forbid, to destroy the Jews. And then there was exile in such a strong way. And there was a gzeirah, there was this terrible decree of Haman, al kol ha-yudin, over all the Jews, minav ad zaken, from youth to old people, little children, women, on one day, Haman wanted to destroy them. B'chol medinot ha-melech, in all the lands of the king. The king was a tremendously powerful ruler. His rule extended very far. And that means that this decree, this terrible decree, was in such a way there was nowhere to flee. You couldn't go anywhere else because everywhere was under the control of Ahasuerus. So now, since we know, since we know, that everything there is in material things, they come because of the spirituality. I'm just getting my little spotlight to, oops. So everything in Gashmiut, in physicality, is because of spiritually. Shahari late din, there is no judgment, lelo dayan, without a judge. And the judgment is what happens here in this world. And the judge is God above, and the spiritual realms above, controlled by God. So move on. So from this it's understood, shegam beruch niyut lemaila, that also in the spiritual realms above, it was something negative happening. There's something negative happening in the spiritual realms. And as a result, there's something terrible happening here in the physical world. And that means the Jewish people were absolutely downtrodden. They were in a very low state. So at first sight, how can we understand it? How can the Talmud say that it was then, at the time of Esther, Mordechai, and Ahasuerus, that the Jews really upheld and really accepted what they began at the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. Eish efshar, how is it possible? Shedavka bizman hagalut, that in the time of such a terrible exile, yeah, inyan na'aleh yoter me'asher b'matan Torah, you could have something more exalted than the time of the giving of the Torah. So much so that, as the Talmud says, she'az ha'keichenu lasot, at the giving of the Torah, they only began to keep the law. Shehayta zu atchala bilvad, it was only the beginning. And as the sages said, as we just read, mikan moda rabba lo raita. This it's an excuse against keeping the Torah, because shekiblu be'ones, they accepted the Torah only because they were forced into it, al yedei kfiya, by being forced. Ve'ilu agma v'kiyum, whereas the final acceptance and real upholding of the Torah, hayadavka bizman hagalut v'agzera, was at the time of exile and this terrible decree. So how can it possibly be that this wonderful spiritual time of the giving of the Torah in some sense is weaker than the time of exile and of persecution and of terrible decrees by Haman? That is when they really accepted the Torah. Now we get the explanation of this, which is a very fascinating explanation. Goes back to Rabbi Shneur Zalman, the first Chabad Rebbe, who taught this in his Hasidic teachings, and that's what it's going to explain now. Umavayim b'mayim, and it explains in the discourse being said by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak in 1927 in the brightly lit synagogue in Moscow, and which was astonishing. Just everyone was crowded there. It was like against nature. It was beyond nature doing this in Moscow, of all places, at the very heart of communism at that point. Shebizman hagalut, that at the time of exile, kasha'amad aleim Haman, when the evil Haman stood up against the Jews, hine az amdu b'mesirat nefesh, then the Jewish people stood with self-sacrifice, a readiness to die for Judaism. Now, there are different kinds of mesirat nefesh. There are some kinds of mesirat nefesh which are kind of spiritual self-sacrifice, a readiness. But they had begalui, it was a revealed self-sacrifice. As Rabbi Shneur Zalman, the first Chabad Rebbe, his discourse, his teaching, in a book of his teachings called Torah, or the Torah of Light, she'im ratzu lahamir datam. See, it's interesting to see what is the argument. What is Haman so angry about the Jews? And the sages say in the Talmud that Haman, either he saw himself as a god, and he wanted people to worship him. And that's why Mordechai wouldn't bow down to Haman. You can ask, why didn't Mordechai want to bow down to Haman? Because Haman thought of himself as a god. Or another explanation the Talmud gives, not he thought of himself as a god, but he had an idol on his chest. So if Mordechai would bow down to Haman, he would be bowing down to that idol, even though it's normal, conventional, sort of royal behavior is that when there is a royal personage or a significant figure in those days, even today to some extent, people would bow down to them, a woman would curtsy, that still happens today. But it is the fact that Haman thought of himself or of the idol on his chest as a god, and bowing down to him was accepting him as a god. And because Mordechai didn't want to bow down to him, so he's rejecting that idol. Now, so what it says in Torah, in Rabbi Shneur Zalman's teaching, is that if the Jewish people would have said, Haman, forget about Mordechai, we all accept you as our deity, and we're all going to bow down to you. You are the, you or your idol, We all worship you. Lo haya Haman or Selahim Klum. Then Haman wouldn't have done anything to them. You see, his decree was on the Yehudim, on the Jews. Now, this word Jew is very rare in the Tanakh, in the Bible, funnily enough. And it's in the book of Esther that we first have that word used, describing the Jewish people. And the Talmud says, what does this mean, Yehudim? Normally, there were Jews from the tribe of Judah, and one could say that a Yehudi is a person from the tribe of Judah. But Mordechai himself was actually from the tribe of Benjamin. And nonetheless, and it says that in the Megillah, and nonetheless, he's described as Yehudi. So what is the meaning of the word Yehudi, which comes to mean the word Jew? So the Talmud says, anyone who denies idolatry is a Jew, is a Yehudi. So the word Yehudi means not only that he's Jewish, but that he denies idolatry. So they denied, so Haman, his decree was only on the people denying idolatry. If, God forbid, they would have accepted idolatry, then that would have been all right. He wouldn't have wanted to kill them. But they gave over their lives, lamut, to die, kol hashana kula, for the whole of that year of the decree of Haman. V'lo ala lehem machshevet chutz chas v'shalom, and they didn't have a single extraneous thought, oh, let's convert to Haman's religion. Heim benogeh lemachshava, whether in their thoughts, they didn't think of doing such a thing, heim benogeh ledibur, or in their speech, heim benogeh lemasa, or even in, or certainly not in their action. They were determined to give up their lives rather than doing anything. Doing some action, neged emunat Hashem echad, an action against the faith of the one God. To like bowing down to an idol, av she'enu ma'amin bo klal b'libo, even though the person doesn't believe in it at all in their heart. You see, a person could say to themselves, I don't believe in this idol. It means nothing to me. I'm dedicated to God. But why should I throw my life away? I'll bow down to the idol just to have a quiet life, and I'll be able to go on serving God. Well, they didn't do that. And during the and through history, Jews very often took the choice, like the Crusaders said to them in the Middle Ages, baptism or death, or it was quite often a call to the Jewish community, baptism or death. And the Jews chose death very, very often. Sometimes they did get forced into baptism, as in Spain, for example, you have the Muranos, who then tried to keep Judaism secretly. Also happened under Islam with the Almohades. Here we have the idea that they are not going to even bow down to this idol, even though they don't believe in it at all. And they could just say it's a meaningless thing, as we have the famous story in the Midrash, that there was the Roman emperor. He was trying to get the children, the seven sons of Hannah, to bow down to an idol. And each one refused to bow down, and he killed each one by one. And then came the seventh, who was a very beautiful little boy. And the emperor was very upset. He didn't want to kill this boy. He looked such a nice boy. He said, look, I'll put my ring in front of the idol. You go over, pick up the ring, and it doesn't mean anything to you. And everyone will think you've bowed down to the idol, and I'll be able to spare your life. And the boy refused. He didn't want to do that. So that was the situation also at Purim, that the Jews did not want in any way to even look like they're bowing down to Haman's idol. As the Alter Rebbe, as Reb Shneur Zalman, writes about this in Tanya, the idea of not wanting to serve an idol in any way, even just by meaningless action. And as explained elsewhere in another discourse or set of discourses, Shemesirut nefesh zu, that this self-sacrifice of the Jewish people, Pa'ala, had the effect, liyot vayikatz te yashen Hashem, that, so to speak, God woke up. It seemed as if God was silently watching the terrible things that were happening, but then God woke up, so to speak, and got involved. Of course, it's metaphorical and so on, because God is always concerned, but it looked as if God was sleeping, so to speak, in relation to the Jewish people. And that's the phrase in the Megillah, Balayla hahu nadadashnat hamelech. That night, the sleep of the king was disturbed. Now, this is the part of the story where Ahasuerus can't sleep. So they read the Book of Chronicles to him, and comes up the story of how Mordechai had saved his life. And he asked, had any reward been given to Mordechai? And they said no. And at that moment, Haman comes in, wanting to have Mordechai hung, and he wants permission from the king to allow him to do that. And the king says to him, what would you suggest should be done for the man whom the king wants to honor? And Haman thought it meant him. And he said, oh, he should be dressed in the royal clothes with the royal crown and the royal horse, and he should ride on the horse. And a man should walk next to him saying, this is the man that the king wishes to honor. So the king said to Haman, that's a wonderful idea. Go get Mordechai and put him on the horse and give him the crown, and you walk next to him and say, this is the man who the king wants to honor. And in the story of the Book of Esther, that's really the turning point. It's at that point everything changes, and from then on everything goes well for the Jewish people. That's the turning point in the story. So the Kabbalistic explanation is, Balayla hu nadadashnat hamelech, the king, it's not just King Ahasuerus, it's God, the king. The apparent sleep of God was disturbed, stopped, and v'al yedei zeh, and through this, nitbatla hagzeira, the decree was cancelled through the whole machination with Esther and the banquet with the king and with Haman, and the king saying to Esther, why have you made this banquet? So what is it that you want? I'll give you half my kingdom. She says, I just want my life and the life of my people. And there's someone threatening to kill us all. And the king said, who's threatening to kill you? She says, this evil Haman who's next to us. And a few minutes later, Haman is put to death. So that was the cancellation of the decree. Now, since at the time of this decree, they had this tremendous sense of self-sacrifice for Judaism. That's why then the Jews were able to accept at Purim, at the time of Ahasuerus, what they'd begun to do at the giving of the Torah, shekimu, that they kept ma shekiblu kva b'matan Torah, what they had already accepted at the giving of the Torah. So let's stop sharing for a moment, and let's just see if we understand this, or are there any comments or questions. Rabbi Lou, have you got any comment to make at this stage? You're muted. No,
yeah, I know. Yeah, it's beautiful. I'm enthralled with your explanation and giving over the actual story of the Megillah and how it corresponds, parallels what was happening in the spiritual universe. The whole story of Purim, there's no miracles there. Just a lot of coincidences, you know, very fortunate serendipity. And that's the story of life. That's really the essence of God.
Could I ask a question?
Yes.
Are the Jews the only ones that oppose or resent idolatry?
At that time, yes.
But not... And now?
It then depends what you call idolatry.
See, that's it. So because it's Talmud, anyone that isn't it, he's a Jew. The Jewish is a...
I see what you're asking.
That's what I'm asking, yeah.
Right, okay. The Muslims, generally, as far as the Muslims are concerned, they oppose idolatry. And so you're asking, so the Talmud says anyone who opposes idolatry is a Jew. So does that make the Muslims Jewish?
Okay. By definition.
That's an interesting complexity.
But surely the heart of it is that in what he's saying then is that he's saying the heart of being a Jew is knowing who HaKadosh Baruch Hu is. And so that is why Muslims are not Jews, because they recognize one divine being. And perhaps it is the same, I don't know, but they are more distant from Torah and the actual Tanakh that we have, in which we discover who he is, who Hashem is.
There are no Jews, but they qualify by what the Talmud says. That I'm asking if it's, you know, just a bit too much, too broad qualification that the Talmud gives.
All right. Look, Eleanor, what you said is very profound. And Rivka, you've got a point that you have to refine the Talmudic statements a little bit to understand how it applies. Actually, in this discourse, it comes up that the aspect of the divine, there's an aspect of the divine that fills the world and gives the world's existence. And that is something that for non-Jews, that is God, and that's very meaningful. And that aspect of God, they believe it. They have faith. They have faith in God. There's a higher aspect of God beyond the keeping existence, keeping the world or the universe in existence. There's a higher aspect of God which gives the Torah with its very special commandments. And by definition, the person who's not a Jew is not aware in the sense of that aspect of the divine. The seven Noahide laws, it's interesting. On the one hand, they come from that higher aspect of the divine. But it could also sometimes, I mean, the discourse doesn't say this, this is just my suggestion. You could say there's a kind of natural law. By the fact that God keeps existence in existence by a constant flow of godliness making everything exist. So there's a kind of natural law. And that natural law, that's the seven Noahide laws. Now, the seven Noahide laws are, they are sort of emphasized by the transcendent God, the transcendent aspect of God, God who is revealed on Mount Sinai. So natural law in itself is not really enough. But for most people in the world, the struggle of faith is the aspect of the divine, the immanent aspect of the divine filling the world. What the discourse presents is the idea that the immanent aspect of the divine for the Jew is very intimate, in a way, as Eleanor just said. That immanent aspect is very intimate for the Jew, and it's not really a question of faith. Just looking at the world in a rational way will reveal the divine. That aspect of God, which is beyond, that's where the faith of the Jew comes into the picture. So the different dimensions of faith and different dimensions, different aspects of the divine, the immanent and the transcendent. But certainly it's an interesting point that Rivka made, that we would have to sort of refine that Talmudic statement a little bit to make it more clear.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
So we now, thank you for those points. And now let's go on to, we're on page Zion, and we're going to consider the way in which the human body is structured. And this is going to help us understand this relationship where we have the sense of self-sacrifice, which can be seen in a way as the it's the sort of deepest but also lowest aspect of the person. It's not an intellectual stance, it's something that goes beyond that. Va'inyan bazeh, now what this means is, that's page Zion, line 5. Kamavor v'maimas, it says in the discourse of the previous Rebbe of 1927. The three general sections of the body, the human body. Rosh, there's the head. Guf, then the main part of the body. V'regel, and then the legs and the feet. Even though the feet and the legs and the feet are the lowest part of the person, nonetheless, yesh yitaron. One second, I'll just get my little red spotlight. So nonetheless, mikol makom yesh yitram ba'regel. There is an extra quality about the feet and the legs. Shema amidu magbia, it holds up and it lifts up the whole body, gam et harosh, even the head. Val derech ze bechlalut Yisrael, similarly in the whole Jewish people. Kamo shekatuv, so now we are applying this structure to the Jewish people, that you have like the legs of the Jewish people and you have higher parts as well. Now, Kamosha Katov, as it says, now this is something Moses speaks about. Moses says, Sheish Meot Erev Chagli, there's 600,000 feet of Ha'amazah. In other words, 600,000 people, and he calls them feet. Asher Anochi Bekirbo, and I am in their midst. I, Moses, am in their midst. Now, Hasidic teachings transform this sentence. There's a special quality about the lower aspect of the gathering of the Jewish people, the feet or legs of the Jewish people, raglei ha'am, the legs and feet of the people. And it's through this lower aspect of the people, through this na'ase anochi bekirbo. There is, I am in their midst. Now, I, in the verse, I am in their midst, means Moses. I'm here among the Jewish people. But Hasidic teachings transform this. Anochi means God, a very exalted aspect of God. Shehu inyan agilui debchinat keter. This is the revelation of the aspect, keter, crown. Anochi, which is anochi, I, the highest level of I, and it shines into wisdom. And wisdom is Madregato shel Moshe. That's the level of Moses. So that's why the verse is talking about Moses, and at the same time it's talking about God, because it's the keter, the crown, shining into Chochmah, wisdom, and wisdom is the attribute of Moses. V'zoi klalut ha-ma'alah shebizman ha-galut. This is the special quality of the Jewish people at the time of exile. Ubifchad bedara de ikvata de mishicha. The heels of the Messiah, we call our present time the heels of the Messiah. And the heels again is bechinat regal, it's the feet. She'az yeshnam yoteh alamot ha'eserim. Then there are more concealments and hiding of the divine, or a defoot and persecution. It's particularly then, that the concept of self-sacrifice is revealed. So that means it's in a time of persecution when we're at the lowest ebb, that then suddenly comes out this power of self-sacrifice. So there's I find this an incredibly moving thing, and in fact, many years ago, this was the subject of my doctorate in the university, was on the theme of self-sacrifice for Judaism, as taught by the second Lubavitcher Rebbe, particularly. And in fact, this discourse was very important because he gave a whole explanation of this very idea that we're studying now. And so that was a theme, a strong theme in my PhD, my doctorate. So this is a very deep idea, the self-sacrifice of the Jew. And then the Rebbe explains, which is line 19, Shezeu inyana kasho im emuna shelamayla masecha. This connects with the idea of faith above reason. Lelo havana v'hasaga, without understanding, without grasping it in any way. Ukafish mavai b'mayma, as it explains in the discourse, she'ika inyan emuna din shamot Yisrael. The main point of faith, emunah, for Jewish people, hiba madregat sovev kol almin, is this upper aspect of the divine, the transcendent aspect, which is called that which surrounds the world. The bamale kol almin, because the aspect of God which is imminent, which fills the world, zel bifchinat hasaga bipnimiot, this is something that can be grasped by the person in an inward way, ke'ilu ro'eh, as if the person sees godliness. You look at any phenomenon in the world, and with your mind's eye, thinking about, for example, what it says in the second section of Tanya, the gate of unity and faith, the way in which there's a divine life force within everything, a stream of Hebrew letters keeping everything in existence, like a projector shines on the screen, and that's how everything looks to us, that's how we see the physical world. And it can be to the person as real as if they actually see it. So therefore, if it's so apparent to the person, you don't call it faith. Faith is something where mind doesn't, ordinary logic doesn't work. But if one takes it in terms of Hasidic teachings and one looks at the world in that way, then it's a rational acceptance of the nature of the divine within the world. Ki im ikar emunah, the main idea of faith, is v'chinat sovev kol almin, is the upper level, the transcendent level from which comes the Torah with all the special commandments, the 613 commandments, higher, one could say, than the natural law of the seven Noahide laws, right? I'm just suggesting that distinction. She'enu musag v'nirgash, which can't be grasped. And so that's the case for the Jewish people. Now then the Rebbe speaks about the nations of the world. Shebchinat mamale kol almin, for most people in the nations of the world, the immanent aspect of God which fills the world, he etzlam ba'ofen shel emunah, for them it's in a way of faith. Ve'ilun b'chinat soviv kol almin, whereas the transcendent aspect, ein lahem shaychut, they don't connect with that, because the source of law for them and the source of their faith in God is at a lower level, and the laws they have to keep are the seven Noahide laws rather than the 613 mitzvot of the Torah. Now, whether there is in this distinction a distinction between the Chasidei Umot Olam, the righteous Gentiles, and others, I'm not sure, because a righteous Gentile might study what it says in Tanya, in the second section of Tanya, and perceive godliness of the imminent level in a very real and direct way, and perhaps appreciates the transcendent aspect as well in a deeper way. And that's why he or she is a righteous Gentile, because then he keeps the seven Ohad laws in a truly dedicated way. So there might be some distinction there, which the discourse is not going into at this point. However, when we're speaking about the Jewish people, the Inyan Mesirut Nefesh in the Jewish people, is beyond understanding and seichel. Now, of course, it is an important point that there are many non-Jews who give up their lives for their faith. And this is something discussed by the sages hundreds of years ago. And it makes they make a very interesting distinction. Among the non-Jews, generally, the person who gives up his life for his faith is a very dedicated person. And because of that, he gives up his life for his faith. Among the Jews, the people who give up their life for their faith are very often not dedicated people. They're people who in other aspects of their life weren't so religious. And nonetheless, when it came to the crunch, they're ready to give up their life for Judaism. So that's it's the distinction between the person who is a kind of religious personality and very, very dedicated, and therefore he gives up his life for his religion, and the case of a Jew who might have been doing all kinds of wrong things and not behaving properly and not even believing properly, but nonetheless suddenly comes this point of baptism or death, and he chooses death rather than baptism, or whatever the equivalent is at another age. Okay, so are there any points to discuss by anyone?
Rabbi Tally, Jeffrey, the non-Jew can't reach that level, that madrega, to go up that high, are they still able to recognize a Mashiach?
That's a very good point, and I'm sure they can. Yes. Absolutely.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, it's good to know.
if they don't, it would be a problem. The whole concept of Mashiach depends on everyone recognizing.
Well, from what you're saying, there are Jews, non-Jews, who can chap something, but in the main, they're rooted here.
Well, a part of this is our task to communicate spiritual teachings and the seven Noachad laws, which includes awareness of God, as it says in Tanya, in the Gate of Unity and Faith, and so to a certain extent, the responsibility is in our hands.
Right. Koyach. Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay. Any other point from anyone else? Right. Okay. Let's go back to the discourse. Now we come to the practical atmosphere of the time, which I mentioned briefly before, section Gimel of the discourse. And we've got this idea of section Gimel. Now this discourse was said by the previous Rebbe in Russia, where the teachings of Hasidism had been founded in general Hasidism. It was all part of the Russian Empire, and especially the teachings of Hasidut Chabad. And through that, it comes down into Chochma Bina Da'at, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. And the main thing is that it should come down into practical life. So it's there in Russia that we have the idea of the subtle teachings of Hasidism coming down into practical life. And it's there that the previous Rebbe was declaring this discourse that we're discussing. And it was with Mesirut Nefesh Begalui. It was a completely revealed example of self-sacrifice, because who knows what could happen when he is publicly teaching this Hasidic discourse, as it's known what happened at that time, when there was persecution about the idea of Torah mitzvah. And even so, when Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok was in the capital city, Moscow, of that country, of Russia, and that which was the source of all the whole communist movement against religion and against Judaism in particular, then that's when the Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok said this discourse, and in such a way that he said it in a synagogue, and it was the main synagogue, I think, in Moscow. And there it was recognizable even outside in the streets, where people are wandering around in the street, like the non-Jewish environment in the street. Nonetheless, there's a letter which was printed together with this discourse, where it was a spiritually gloomy time when the sun is setting, whether in the simple literal sense that it was dusk, and in a spiritual sense. But in the synagogue, they lit a lot of candles or lights, electric lights maybe. And then when people said, what's going on? Why are all the lights on in the synagogue? So people answered, the leader of the Jewish people is giving a sermon from the Bima. He's giving an inspiring talk. And there were many, many Jews who were there, tens of Jews, 40, 50, 60 people. And they came to hear the words of God being revealed by the Rebbe, as it was the God communicates with the prophets, and through the different prophets they reveal the teaching of God. And when the prophets ceased in the time of the Second Temple, then it comes through the Jewish leaders in each generation. And he was saying in public that from Mipi Oilalim Bayoinkim Yisadata Ois, from the mouths of babes and sucklings, you, God, have established the strength of Torah in order to silence the enemy. So that means, he said, we should take no notice. All these laws against studying Torah and against doing mitzvah, take no notice. We have to work on the idea of the Torah being founded in the right way, as then was the decree of the government, that you couldn't teach children. You had to wait until the child grew up. And that means till they're 18 years old. But no, Ein Oz Ela Torah. Oz means Torah, and we have to be teaching Torah to little children, not only for a child of 13 years old, but also for little babies. We should be teaching them Torah, and through this we will have the effect of La Hashbit Oyev Mitnakem. We will silence and stop the enemy, the avenger, which means the negative force of atheism fighting against Judaism. Now, even though all this Shaykh Lemaimu the Matzav Shahaya Bishnat Tofresh Pezayin, all that applies to the situation, if we're going to look at it literally, to what was happening in 1927. So Shahaya Tzorech Lefol Ainyan, when it was necessary to achieve this, we had to achieve this to silence the enemy, which was revealed, this force which had closed down the Jewish schools and most of the study houses and most of the synagogues. But from this we understand also, also when we study this discourse now, the Rebbe was saying this in 1967, and it applies now as well, 2022. Now, first of all, let's consider. How do we learn a discourse? When we learn a discourse, it has to become the Torah possession of the person who's studying it. It's not just a separate thing. It's not just that the person is an existing thing on himself. And he's studying the discourse of the Rebbe. So there's the person and the discourse, two different things. No, it has to be a unified thing. It has to be the way that the Jews accepted, like this, the name of this discourse, the opening verse. And this is really the content of the whole discourse. You could say it's the content of every discourse, but the fact that the discourse has this, these words, the fact that it says in the footnote, the fact that the discourse begins with these words is the idea that the discourse is emphasizing this has to be received and absorbed by everyone reading it. Al derech ma shekatov Rabbeinu HaZaken b'Shaar Yichud v'Emunah, as the Rabbi Shneur Zalman wrote at the beginning, in the section called the Gate of Unity and Faith, that's the second section of Tanya we've been mentioning a few times now. Sheshmo asher yikru lo v'lishon hakodesh, the name of anything in Hebrew, hu chayuto shel hadavar nikra b'shem zeh, is the life force of the thing called by that name. Now, v'cheinu gam b'shemot shel inyanei ma'amarei Torah, similar when regards to the names of portions of Torah. And this discourse is called V'kibbel HaYehudim, the Jews accepted. So in other words, this idea of the Jewish people, that's us, accepting these teachings, that's what this discourse is all about. U'b'chat shem sh'nitkabel b'rov tfutzot Yisrael, especially a name that among the Jewish people, that's seen as the name of this discourse, or in general, the name of anything, כמובן ממה שכתב הרמב״ם. As the Rambam writes, בנוגע לגזירה ותקנה שפשטה בכל ישראל. Maimonides, the Rambam is writing, this is in the 12th century, he's writing about a decree or a custom that's been accepted throughout the Jewish people. And this has got a strength. It's a decree of the sages. So that this has got a strength of a positive commandment or a negative commandment, because it says in Devarim, al pi haTorah sheYaruha, that when the sages teach you something, the Torah says you've got to follow what they teach. Lo tasu min haDavar sheYagidelcha, don't turn aside from whatever they teach you. Haynu shalimud choder et kol metziyoto. That means the teaching permeates the entire being of the individual who's studying it. And the Rebbe puts it in Yiddish in order to emphasize it, or the transcribers put it in Yiddish. Es nemtim duchen ganzen. It completely takes the person. Umitachedimo. The idea, it unifies itself with the person, liot metziut achat, to be one unity. And as Rabbi Shneur Zalman says in Tanya, yichud nifla, a wonderful unity, she'en yichud kamo, which can't be compared to anything else at all, not in the physical realm and not in the spiritual realm, liot achadim yuchadim, to be so absolutely unified together in every way. So now we're on page Yud, page 10. And then there's a further part, a further aspect, as it's known what the previous Rebbe would say, Shaloi dai b'chach shehu lomed et ha-maimah. It's not enough that a person studies the discourse. Eila ha-maimah tzarich lelamed oto. The discourse has to teach him. V'nogei lahan hagato, concerning the person's activities and behavior. Since there's a command to study the discourse, like every part of Torah, there's certainly the empowerment that our study can be in such a way that it completely permeates us, and it comes out into action. Hein benogel lechlalut inyan mesilat nefesh, both concerning the dedication with which we should be learning Torah, vehein benogel inyan lehashpit oyev mitnakem, and also the idea that through our learning Torah, that has an effect on the world and the enemies of the Jewish people and the enemies of spirituality will be silent.
Amen.
Okay, so now the previous Rebbe is going to explain how this applies in our situation. But in Yom B'zeh, what this means is as follows. The Hine Gam Kasher Nimtzayim B'zman Shel Hachava, even when we're in a time of plenty, yeah, as we are relatively now, Yachol v'tzarich liyod inyan ha'mesilat nefesh, there still needs to be dedicated, real dedication, really self-sacrifice, not in terms of life or death, but in terms of going beyond oneself. V'nogeh l'limud ha'Torah, as regards the study and teaching of Torah. As it says in the discourse, V'hine amru rabotenu zal, the sages said, Gadol ma'aseh yoter min ha'oseh. Originally, this is talking about giving charity. Now, you know, in giving charity, okay, so someone can say, you know, there's need for charitable donations. They put up a notice in the public place and, you know, they send out a WhatsApp and they say charity is needed for this thing. And so whoever wants to give will give. Another way of getting charity is that someone comes up to you, phones you up, hello, listen, I want you to try and donate to this cause. It's an important thing. It's something very necessary. Or it's someone you meet. It's a friend of yours. And they are trying to get you to give charity. Now, this person who is tangibly involved in getting others to give charity, the Talmud says that's getting other people to do it is greater even than doing it yourself. Now that, so that can apply with the idea of supporting Torah study, like you've got the idea of the two tribes, Zvulun and Yisachar. So it says, rejoice Zvulun in your going out, making money. The Zvulun was they were business people with fleets of ships. And Yisachar, they studied Torah in their tents. So they made a kind of a partnership where Zvulun went out and did the business and he gave some of that money to Yisachar so that they're able to study Torah. So Zvulun comes before Yisachar because the Torah of Yisachar comes through Zvulun. So therefore, the idea of giving charity or getting others to give charity is something very important. Now the Rebbe applies that to getting people to learn Torah. Okay, so the idea of getting people to give tzedakah, that's a popular thing in Talmudic and Jewish religious thought. But now he's applying it to persuading people to study Torah. Now this, in a sense, is more than even the individual who's studying Torah. The fact that you get others to do it. And the same way it is with charity, getting people to give charity for the needs of learning Torah, so it is with learning itself. Greater is the one who gets his friend to learn Torah more than the one who's actually learning himself, because this is a kind of giving of, it's a kind of generosity in his soul. Like one could say, for example, if you make a public study session and among people who are not necessarily able to study the material themselves. So that could be, you might say for the person doing it, he could say, oh, well, I would like to study on a much more advanced level. But no, Hasidic teachings say it's very right what you're doing. You are teaching people, and that's a wonderful thing. This happens to be an extremely elevated discussion group that we have together exploring these discourses. And so it's not Mesilat Nefesh on anyone's part, except the part maybe of people who come. But it's a very beautiful experience that we are studying this together. But you could imagine someone teaching a very like simple subject, and the people coming to his talk, they're learning something that for the teacher is a very simple idea. And he could say to himself, well, if I wasn't teaching this simple material, I could be studying something very advanced, like a discourse that we're studying together. But so he could be spoken of as having self-sacrifice in teaching these simple things to people. So even though the other person is keeping the mitzvah, so now we're analyzing the person teaching the simple thing and how you score, as it were, you know, in keeping the mitzvah of studying Torah. Even though the person teaching the simple thing to the group of people and they are learning it, so they're keeping the mitzvah of learning Torah. But the teacher isn't really keeping that mitzvah properly because he's able to learn at greater depth. And as we learn from the later sages, if someone is able to learn at a greater depth and he learns only in a superficial way, so it's considered that he's not learning Torah properly. As we see, for example, that people studying Torah in a deep way, but then comes the time of hearing the Megillah, so they have to go and hear the Megillah. So it's a mesirat nefesh. It's a self-sacrifice of the teacher. Instead of studying something deep, like a discourse like this, but instead of studying something deep, he's studying something very simple, teaching something simple to this group of people who wouldn't be able to study it by themselves. And even he might be teaching little children, right? So that's a tremendous challenge. One needs chadarim, one needs the children to have teachers, good teachers, inspiring teachers. And so the inspiring teacher might say, I can't teach little five-year-olds, six-year-olds. I want to be writing commentaries on the Talmud. So it's a kind of self-sacrifice that he's here teaching Aleph Beit, Vayomer Hashem, and God said. He's teaching simple things to children. Nonetheless, and he might even be teaching even younger children. So even so, this person needs this dedication, this self-sacrifice of founding the Torah. Yisada to Oz, you are founding the Torah. Oz, strength means Torah, and he's doing it. And al derech zeh, in a similar way, Lahashbit oyev mitnakem, silencing the enemy. Even though we're in a time of plenty, nonetheless, there is an enemy. Now, what's the enemy? The foreign God inside each individual, the Yetzirah. And that's like the personal enemy that each one of us have. And that means sometimes it's like an enemy, which is an obvious a negative force. And it says in an open way, let's do the opposite of the Torah, God forbid. And sometimes it's like a noken. It's like an avenger, which means in this context that it's a hidden evil, a hidden enemy, which does tricks. It doesn't say, don't keep the Torah. It works in a more cunning way. It tells him that do what the Torah says, but do it mit kunzen, do it in such a way that you don't give too much of yourself into the Torah. And in order to prevent both these different kinds of enemy, we need the service in the way of teaching children and the learning of children, little children. That means to put oneself as if one were oneself a child. And that means leaving behind one's intellect. And that is a mesirat nefesh as well. A self-sacrifice, which means mesirat haratzon, giving over one's will, giving over one's seichel, one's intellect, giving over one's emotions, and leaving it so that one's service is simply a kind of kabbalat ol alone. And that's the way in which, in a more dedicated way, one is able to communicate Torah and live Torah. Now, in this, I'm reminded of a friend of mine of many, many years ago. We lost touch mostly. He was studying at that time to be a concert pianist. And he would tell me about what his piano teacher, a Jewish lady, he was Jewish as well, a Jewish lady, a Hungarian lady, a wonderful piano teacher, and how she was teaching him. And there was a certain rondo, I think it was by Bartok, a little piece. And the piano teacher said to him, forget everything you know about music. Yes, you've been studying music many years. This man had actually been a child prodigy at the age of 11. He conducted played with the Philadelphia Philharmonic Orchestra, something like that, like a child prodigy musician. So she says to him, and now he's like 25 and pretty experienced. She says, forget everything you know. Just play this little Bartok rondo as if you were a child. And that was the way she wanted him to play this little piece, this little piano piece by the great composer Bartok, the Hungarian composer, in a very, very simple, simple way. And so I think of that here, this idea of going beyond any kind of intellect, just having the simple dimension of simple dedication. So are there any comments at this point by anyone? No, okay. So what this means is, now, the power to do this relates actually to the discourse we learned last week, even though this is in a different year. The power to do this is from Moses. As it explains in the discourse by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, explaining the verse of last week's Sedra, Va'ata tatzavet b'nei Yisrael, you command the Jewish people and let them bring to you pure olive oil to make a perpetual light. And this tzivui tatzavet is explained in this discourse as tzavta v'chibur, bonding together, joining people together. The role of the teacher, of the inspiring Rebbe, is to connect people to God, to join people to God and to each other. And that means that Moses, he is the one who joins the souls of the Jewish people and gives them the power to light this perpetual light. And that means through the fact that he is the one who feeds the Jewish people in their faith. And that means he strengthens us in our faith in God, as it's already explained here, the profundity, the greatness of this faith, which is in the transcendent aspect of the divine. And in similarly, there is the spreading out of Moses through all the generations, the leaders of the Jewish people through the generations, and they are the shepherds who strengthen faith in God with self-sacrifice. And in our generation, says the Rebbe, it's the previous Rebbe. He's the one who gives the power that there should be this service in a constant, perpetual way. As it says, Shivisi Hashem Lenegdi Tomid, I put before me God always. I always perpetually consider God before me. And the idea of Tov Lev Mishteh Tomid, the person who has a happy heart, it's as if he's always saying Mechaim, drinking perpetually. And so that's the idea of Purim as well, because on Purim there's a mitzvah to drink a little bit of extra wine, whiskey, vodka, until one doesn't know, like beyond knowledge. And that's higher than seichel, higher than intellect. And that is the concept of self-sacrifice. So that idea of going beyond, of a dedication which goes beyond. And that is something which is given to us by Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, the same way that we have the idea of the Mesirat Nefesh, like the legs, the feet, in the days of Purim, and that is really the completion of the giving of the Torah, as we've learned, Similarly, through Mesirat Nefesh now, which is service with Kabbalat Ol, acceptance of the yoke and doing what one is supposed to do. Sometimes one has a question, why should the mitzvah be this way or that way? But simply putting oneself into it and saying, let's do it. So not only does this have the effect of silencing the enemy, and that one is able to be successful in all aspects of service of God, learning Torah, the revealed Torah, the Hasidic dimension, keeping mitzvot in a very careful way, praying in a meaningful way, but further, one also has the true giving of the Torah in a revealed way of the inwardness of Torah of the future. Now, that's a very interesting thing, that what we do now can relate to the revelation, the extra further revelation of the inwardness of Torah in the future, in the time of Mashiach. As it's known that even though the giving of Torah was a one-time event and it won't happen again, since everything has already been given in the Torah, nonetheless, the revealing of the inner dimension, that will be in the future. As it says about the future in the Song of Songs, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, which means the inner teachings of Torah being communicated to us. And this is something that depends on the way that we behave now in exile. Here we are in the last few lines of the discourse. And that includes also the idea of spreading the wellsprings, which means the spreading the inner dimension of Torah. And that is similar to the revelation of the inner dimension of Torah that will be in the time of Mashiach. So the Rebbe is telling us, my friends, that when we study this teaching, what we're doing now, which is the wellsprings of the Torah, we're actually doing something which has a little bit of the tinge of the study of Torah as it will be in the time of Mashiach. And through this, we come to the idea of, in our relationship with God, he will kiss me with the kisses of his mouth in the future, in the time of the Mashiach. Then there'll be kept that idea that your teacher, God, will no longer be concealed. And we had something just like that at the giving of the Torah. And before we spoke about how tremendous the giving of the Torah was, but it was only for a short time. But it'll be in a kind of permanent way and in a complete way in the future with the coming of Mashiach. And that's something we can experience now on Purim Katan today and Shushan Purim Katan. And how much more B'Chag HaPesach, that's in about 6 weeks' time. And then we'll already be in Jerusalem, the holy city, with the coming of Mashiach Tzidkenu, and with the help of God, we'll all be celebrating the beautiful festival of Pesach together. So see you there.